All right, welcome to the Centurions, parts 8 and 9, looking at the leading Jews of the 8th and 9th centuries of the Common Era, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib. As the 8th century began, the Jews were settled in Bavel and achieved something close to stability or normality. The office of the Reish Galusa was still contentious, as the heirs of the two wives of Bustanai contested every succession. But in any event, the people turned for leadership to the Gaonim and not to the Reish Galusa. The Rosh Yeshiva had more credibility and more to offer. The Muslims, then the Umayyad dynasty, ruled Bavel from a distance, from Damascus, and therefore the Jews of Bavel were not directly involved with them, and those Muslims were preoccupied with war and conquest. Nothing changes. But a series of Muslim defeats, first at Constantinople and then at the Battle of Tours in France, all in the first third of the century, halted the Muslim encroachment on European soil. And within decades after that defeat, the Umayyads were overthrown by another Muslim band, the Abbasids, who took control over the entire Middle East and moved its seat of government inside Bavel and closer to the center of the Jewish world. The Umayyads were left with their caliphate in Spain and not much else. But for three centuries thereafter, the Abbasids governed with benevolence, like the Umayyads, more or less. The Jews benefited because the Abbasids championed knowledge and progress, science, mathematics, philosophy, medicine. They're very cultured. It was the golden age of Muslim life, certainly a far cry from the barbarism that emerges today from much of the Muslim world. And one of the advantages of the Muslim conquest is that it brought most of the Jewish world under the control of one government. So no longer was the world divided into Byzantines and Persians, Visigoths, Vandals, and assorted other primitive tribes. So this allowed for greater and more facile interactions between Jewish communities across the civilized world, and it eased correspondence between those Jewish communities and cemented the role of Sura and Pumbedisa as the sources of Torah authority. So it is in this fertile environment that the Jews of Bavel prospered materially, but more important, spiritually, with something new and historic that would shape this century and forever after. And that is the publication of the first Sfarim. Of course, we always had the Tanakh. Tanakh is well over a millennium old now. And the Mishnah was 6 centuries old. And the Talmud had been completed about 300 years earlier. But the first Sefer with a named and known author now was published and served the vital function of bringing the ideas of Torah to the masses in a systematic way outside the framework of the Tanakh and the Talmud. And that was published in the 8th century and by our centurion of the 8th century, Rav Achai Gaon. Rav Achai, like many great people, lived a controversial life, was not always appreciated by his contemporaries, but he made something positive out of a bad situation. He was born in Shabcha, a town near what is today Basra in southern Iraq, in the year 680. He learned in Pumbedisa, he was the leading Talmud in Pumbedisa, and he was in line to be Gaon. But when Rav Shmuel bar Mori, the Gaon of Pumbedisa, died, the Reish Galusa, Shlomo bar Chisdai, bypassed Rav Achai Gaon and appointed instead the Talmud of Rav Achai, Natrai Kahana Barav Emuna of Baghdad, as the new Gaon of Pumbedisa. Well, there are two immediate consequences. First, Rav Achai Gaon was called Gaon, even though he was technically not a Gaon, as the term was used then. Then it meant either the Rosh Yeshiva of Sura or Pumbedisa. So thus he became the very first person in Jewish history actually to be called a Gaon, because he was a Gaon in Torah, and not just as a title or because of any formal position. And Gaon was a term that was used sparingly back then and most promiscuously today. Today we have a Gaon inflation. But the second consequence was Rav Chai Gaon left Bavel in a huff, and he made Aliyah, taking up residence in the land of Israel. This occurred around the year 750, and in due course, many of his disciples from Pumbedisa followed, and the land of Israel had a renaissance, and this just a few years after an earthquake had devastated Tveria in 748. So in Israel, his followers built a number of shuls and yeshivos, and it was there that Rav Chai Gaon put the final touches on his magnum opus, the She'iltos, literally the questions. Now, there was much discussion among scholars and little unanimity about the nature of the work, its genesis, even its authorship. Some say it was Rav Chai's work, others attribute much of it to his Talmidim. Some say he wrote it all in Bavel, others say it was in Israel, or both. What are the She'iltos? They're a compendium of mainly halachic discourses that are organized according to the weekly sedra. So it usually encompasses an area of halacha that's either loosely connected to the sedra or is mentioned explicitly therein. The Meiri writes that it was written in a simple style. Maybe for them, for us it's not so simple, but for them it was, because Rav Chai Gaon had a son who did not wish to apply himself in learning, so the Torah was spoon-fed to him. That was instead of having him sit over Gemara, Rav Chai Gaon gave him these halachic areas in the dozens, in the hundreds really, and he would learn Torah that way. So every sedra has a halacha, has a question, a practical question, has some mussar, and has the answer to the question as well. The Meiri writes that this work, he says in his introduction to Avos, it's one of those publications you can rely on in everything that it says, and it became a major work in its time, circulated widely by manuscript, of course, but first published in the form we have it today in Venice in the late 16th century. It's a book of drushos. It's really geared for Shabbos. That's why it follows the sedros. And many hold that that was its origin as the Shabbos drusha, so that in one sitting, a simple Jew would learn about the sedra, about an area of halacha with all its pertinent details, and listen to a halachic question and response in order to confirm the eternal relevance of Torah. Now, part of the attraction of the She'iltos is that the Jewish people had to wrestle with a new distraction in the 8th century. That was the rise of the Karaites, Anan ben David, tell the story briefly, was the nephew of the Reish Galusa, Reb Shlomo. That was the same one who had overlooked Rav Chai Gaon as the Gaon of Pumbedisa. The nephews became candidates for the position of Reish Galusa because no son of Shlomo was worthy. Some say he didn't even have a son. And when Anan's brother, Hananya, was selected instead of himself, Anan protested, and he declared himself the Reish Galusa, and he was summarily arrested for rebellion against the authorities by the caliph. In prison, Anan was advised by a Muslim inmate, at jailhouse lawyers back then as well, to claim that he represents a different religion, and so cannot be guilty of treason, meaning he's not violating the norms of the community of Israel when he represents a different religion altogether. And that's what Anan did. That was his claim. It was a claim that led the caliph to free him. And Anan centered his religion around a complete rejection of the Masorah, of the Torah Sheba'al Peh, concocting a religion along the literal lines of the Torah. Famously, we know spending Shabbos in the dark and not leaving their homes, Al Yaseh Ish Mikom on the Shabbos, never seeking medical attention from anyone, Kani Hashem Rofecha, changing the laws of Shechita, which are not explicit in the Torah, fasting on Purim, and Purim Katan for that matter, because since it was rabbinic holiday, he didn't accept it, and many others as well. And naturally, every rebellion against the Masorah attracts a following. Who would have thought? And Jews spent centuries both joining the Karaites, combating the Karaites, who were influential really through the Rambam's time. They still exist today in their original form, although just a few thousand people, all told. But now they appear in a similar guise in the Reform movement, although, of course, with an entirely different focus and origination. The Shiltos, therefore, acquainted the average Jew every week with the unity of the Tarsha B'Chsav and Tarsha B'Alpeh. That became, in fact, a focus of Tanakh commentary in the 19th century, also in response to the Reform movement, the Malbim and Rav Hirsch, and the Torah Tmima and Aksava Kabbalah. All those works really had one intent, and that is to show the wholeness of the Torah B'Chsav and Torah B'Alpeh, that they're intertwined. So the first work that really did this was the Shiltos, and in a sense it was counter-Karaite in effect, and if not even in intent. So what were the Shiltos? We can get a flavor of it from last week's Sedra. I have one of the more recent editions of the Shiltos. It was popularized more in the Jewish world a little over a century ago by the Netziv. Actually, it's not a century and a half ago. The Netziv wrote a commentary on the Shiltos called Hamekshe Elah, in which he fleshes out some of the discussions. So it's actually a very good example to use. We just read Shmos 2 days ago. So what halachic areas were discussed in Shmos? Yeah, it's a good question. There's no mitzvah in Taryag that's mentioned in Shmos, and yet Rav Haigon wrote at length about a variety of scenarios that engender halachic discussions. One case we have, you recall that Moshe Rabbeinu was nearly killed by the Malach for failing to circumcise his son. So that leads to a discussion of the laws of Mila, She'ilta. D'mechayvin d'beis Yisrael l'mimal mehulasa l'tamnia yomei v'adifa mehilusa d'afilu Shabbos disreskilohi ki misrame yomei d'tami b'Shabbos d'chinon l'Shabbos min kami mehilusa. So he starts a long discussion of the laws of Mila, of Mila that falls on Shabbos, even who is the one who took the tzor and circumcised the son who had not received Mila yet. That raises the question, can a woman be a male as well? Which of course the Gemara discusses, and it's a machlokas in the Rishonim as well. That generates a discussion of the laws of Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbos, provoked by an introductory statement that relates to the slavery in Egypt and the way that we're supposed to treat each other. The next one, She'ilta, D'mechayvin D'beis Yisrael R'achome Chag B'chagrei. A Jew has to show compassion to another Jew, Shenema V'chei Ochicha Imach. The lives of your brethren are with you, and you're responsible for it. V'odiv Kamishmai L'kayome Neshama D'afilu Shabbos. This is Skila Mechal L'kayome Neshama. And he goes on to discuss the laws of Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbos, and then goes back to the laws about discussing the care for a child after Mila, even on Shabbos. Alright, what else happened in Mitzrayim? They suffered from persecution, from poverty. So now he says, Shilta, Flamites, De Asilahon, De Beis Yisrael, Alome Aina Min Anya. A Jew is not allowed to turn away from the poor. V'tzarech l'me'aved be'tzdoko, v'tzarech l'alboshei, v'chasoyei, u'meitin le'mizonei. You have to give the poor tzdoko and food and clothing, etc. Then there's something else as well, which is also part of the Sedra, the suspicions that were generated of Moshe and Aaron by the people when they failed. He has a long discussion of the laws of Don L'Kavzchus, with all the stories in the Gemara of judging people favorably, not unfavorably. I would assume this was not the drasha all on one Shabbos, but was over a number of years and even over many years as well. All right, just so you should think ahead, we didn't read Va'era yet. But what are the halachic areas in Vaera? Also, there's no mitzvah in the Torah, none of Taryag that are found in Vaera, but there is a famous halacha that he mentions here. Torah says, Veikach Aaron es Elisheva bas Aminadav achos nafshon lo leisha. Aaron married Elisheva, who was the daughter of Aminadav, who is the brother of Nafshon. Alright? Why does the Torah mention her brother? So he writes, Mimashma Shenemer Bas Aminadav Eini Yodesh Achos Nafshon Ela Mikan Lenosa Isha Tzarch Livdok V'Achel. A person who marries a woman should investigate the personality of her brother, because many times the sisters take on the personalities of their brothers. Tana Rov Bonim Dom Lachayim, and the children also will take after their uncles. So this sparks an analysis of choosing a wife and preference in choosing a wife and laws of marriage, etc. And then towards the end of the sedra, the laws of Kiddush Hashem. All in all, it's a remarkable work. It's a work similar, I shouldn't say similar because this is a prototype, but many works follow this in terms of relating the sedra to a particular halachic area, but it's made much more remarkable by its antiquity as well as its precision. The Ravid writes in the Sefer Kabbalah that Chazal have scrutinized the Shiltos and not found any mistake in it. Which to the Ravid, of course, was a major statement, but nonetheless, I can't think of another Sefer that exists in which you can't find something in error or something to quibble with. Just a few decades later, the Shiltos were extensively utilized in the other classic work from the 8th century, and that's Halachos Gedolos, of Rav Shimon Kayora of Basra, then of Sura, which is the first work organized according to halachic topics. It's topical, starting with Hilchos Brachos, and again, an order that we're very familiar with us, and here we're talking in the 8th century. So these two Svarim introduced a new possibility in Talmud Torah. Not just Talmud, but shorter and more targeted discussions of specific areas that people could learn and discuss. Now the Shiltos also cites Talmudic statements that are not found in the Talmud, as well as Gersos, texts that are different. And the Shiltos themselves, probably because of their antiquity, have come down to us in various forms. And of course there was one published even in the 20th century, but the one that became more popular is that of the Netziv with his commentary. And all began with Rav Achai Gaon. So he died either in 752, meaning he did not live in Israel all that long, or in 762, but his was the first work of its kind and set a pattern for Jewish scholarship, both in terms of the transmission of the Masorah and responding to the challenges of the generation to wit the Karaites. And he therefore remains the great and enduring figure of the 8th century. So tonight, as well as last time, I combined the centuries. Again, there's a paucity of a historical record about Jewish life in those eras. I can't think of a century prospectively where that will be the case. Simply as we approach modern times in the last millennium, there is an infinite historical record. But not so. So here in the 9th century, you have something quite similar to the 8th, another historic work that's the most enduring legacy of the 9th century, and that was the first Siddur, and known to us as Seder of Amram Gaon. So its composer was Rav Amram Gaon, you knew that already, and his life spanned most of the 9th century. Well, what was going on then? Much was happening in the world during Rav Amram's lifetime. Charlemagne was conquering Western Europe and crowning himself the Holy Roman Emperor. The Arabs were ravaging Southern Europe. The Jews were moving into Germany and coining a new language, Yiddish. And in Babel, life was riven by a rivalry between Sura and Pumbedisa, fueled again by a series of disputes between the Reshei Galusa, and for a time even there were rival Gaonim in Pumbedisa because they couldn't settle on one based on the conflicts they were having. When they made peace, these two Gaonim, from Padisa began to eclipse Sura as the leading yeshiva, but not before Sura was led by two extraordinary men. One was Rav Natronai Gaon, who was appointed a Gaon in 853, the great Talmud Chacham, and he became one of the leading authors of Tshuvos during the entire period of the Tekufas HaGaonim, fielding questions from across the Jewish world, including Spain, which is the westernmost outpost in the Jewish world, as well as the civilized world. How were they communicating with each other? There wasn't any mail service to speak of, nor email as far as I know. So the answer is, the questions and answers were carried back and forth by Jewish merchants and traders who were traveling the world. And it was because the world that we're talking about was all under Muslim domination that there was easy relations between the various Jewish communities, as well as trade and spiritual interaction between the Jews of Spain and Babel, and points in between as well. So one question came from Spain while Rav Natronai Gaon was the head of Sura. The question was, you know, Gemara says that a Jew is obligated to make 100 brachos a day. Alright, Ma Hashem Elokecha Doresh Meimach, the Mer Darshan's Ma Ameya, God asks 100 brachos. We recite 100 brachos every day. So they asked, what are these brachos? What are the 100 brachos that a Jew should recite every day? Rav Natronai Gaon spelled out the entire procedure for them. But this question would soon inspire another one that would be even more momentous. We'll get back to in a little while. Rav Natronai Gaon's leading disciple in Sura was Amram Bar Sheshna, who himself became renowned for his responsa as well. Over 200 of his tshuvos survived. In one of them, very interestingly and curiously, Rav Amram Gaon prohibited lending of money on interest to non-Jews. Prohibited it, even though the Torah says openly to do it. Permitting, though, avak ribis. Rambam says that it's a mitzvah to lend money on interest to non-Jews, but of course the Rambam wasn't alive yet. He was still two, 3 centuries from when he was alive. So where does this come from? This is, you find the Tshuvas HaGaonim in Shari Tzedek Chelek Dalad, V'hod Amrina, quotes the Pasuk, Mar Behono B'Neshech V'Sarbis L'Chonim Dal Mikabtsenu, a person who gets his wealth from interest, he'll wind up scattering it to the poor, meaning he'll lose it. And the Gemara says, Omer of Nachman Lehuna Afilu Ribis Degai, even interest to a non-Jew. Vahani Mili Beribis Kitsutsa, the Osula Havos Gai Beribis. That means actual interest, which is forbidden even to lend money on interest to a non-Jew. Avak Ribis, the dust of Ribis you can. Avak Ribis, it's a little complicated area, but the case that he mentions is fairly simple. If you lend someone, say, $100, he has to pay you back $100. He can't give you $100 worth of fruit, because then you get involved in a scenario. Maybe the fruit was worth more or less when he lent you the money. So if you did it, that would be avak ribis. But Amram Gaon said no, because matirin heim v'dineihem lahavol zeh ezeh, that the non-Jews are permitted to do it to each other. Af onu matir lahalvoson, so too we could do it as well, but the Talmud Chacham should not do it, as the Pasuk in Tehillim Tes Zayin, Tes Vav, Kasfalo nasan b'neshech, afilu ribus goyim. What's the background? I don't know, the truth is very brief, but it just seems to me that in the Muslim world, lending money on interest is also banned. So therefore, if Amram Gaon did not want to be in a position of having Jews lend money in it to non-Jews in an environment where non-Jews banned it as well, so he said not to do it. Well, it's an interesting case that some Yekis should think about. V'hochi Omer of Amram Gaon, Notal Yodov lo yekadesh el ayayin. The person washes his hands, he should not then make kiddush on wine. Meaning once you've washed, you should make hamotzi. Yayin matam, yayin ain't tzarech matilos yadayim, kishol noga bevesa kisa. You don't have to wash for wine or for any type of peros or the extract of peros. This is old Yeki minute to wash first. He didn't know the Ramah. He didn't know the Ramah either, correct. He says, no, the person washes hands, you can't make kiddush, you have to then go right to hamotzi. Rav Amram Gon was so universally recognized for his Torah knowledge that, and this was unprecedented, Rav Natronai Gon designated him the Gon of Sura while he, Rav Natronai, was still alive. Even though Rav Amram humbly refused to accept the title and to assume the position as Rosh Yeshiva of Sura during Rav Natronai Gon's lifetime. Rav Natronai Gon died in 857, and Rav Amram Gon served then as Gon until his death in 875. So his great work was that first Siddur that I alluded to earlier, which also came about as a result of a question from the Jews of Spain, in this case apparently Barcelona. Yeah, it's the 9th century, we're talking quite a while ago. The question was simple. What is the order of Tfilos throughout the year? You may call weekdays, Shabbos, Yom Tovim. Rav Amram Gon set out to compile a book that he called the Siddur, literally the order. Of course, we retain that name until today. And it became the basic text of Jewish life. You could take the Seder of Rav Amram Gon, even today, and pick it up, and I'd say 90% of the Tfilah is the same. You feel very comfortable using his Siddur in any shul. From the time of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, which is roughly 4 centuries before the Common Era, they drafted the Shmon Esrei and the Brachos and Baruch Shama, Yishtabach. From that time until this time, there had not been a systematic compilation of what Jews daven. Because of Amram Gon's Siddur, that remains the basic prototype for our Siddur until today. It's still extant, but its original form is disputed for very good reason. I'll mention in a moment. But he begins his Siddur as follows. Amram bar Sheshna, Reish Mesifta de Moso Machsia, Amram the son of Sheshna, who's Reish Yeshiva in Machsia, which was the main city. Sura was a suburb. Rabbeinu Yitzchak, Breda Maronov, Rabbana Shimon, Chaviv Yakiv, Nechbar Aleinu, Ba Yeshiva Kula. Shalom Rav, Merachmonos HaShemayim Yalech, Ba Zarecha. Greetings of peace, the mercies of heaven should be on you and your descendants, and to all the scholars and students and our brothers of Israel who were dwelling there, Seu Shalom Imenu. Get peace from him, Umin Rav Tzemach, free me from us, Umin Rav Tzemach, Avbeistin Yisrael. Rav Tzemach was the Avbeistin in Sura, he would succeed the Rav Amram Gon. Umin Alufim, Chachma Yeshiva, Vnei Yeshiva Shalom, Vishalir Machsia, and from all those who are learning here, Shekulam Vishalom, Chachamim Tamidim, Acheni Yisrael, Shrim Khan, Shetamid Anushalim, Vishlomchem. That we are always inquiring as to your welfare and thinking about you. Zichron Tov, good thoughts. You see, we have a tendency to think that there was no interaction really. And it would be natural to think that, because how much did a non-Jew in Spain have to do with a non-Jew in Greece or a non-Jew in Basel? It wasn't like that. The same way, even today, we pray for Jews across the globe, they did as well. We daven for you, we seek God's compassion on you, God should protect you and save you from every travail or harm, every illness or pain, and from bad governments as well, the latter being the most prevalent. From all types of destroyers and harm that comes to the world, and God in His mercy should fulfill all the desires of your heart. It says, it's an interesting sociological note, he received the question, with the question he receives some money as well. So as part of the text, he gives a receipt. The Jews in the exile were supporting the yeshivos in Babel, both the exile, but they were supporting the leading yeshivos. Shagar lefanena Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Rabbana Yitzchak asaros zehuvim sheshagar to the yeshiva. Rabbeinu Yaakov brought 10 golden coins to the yeshiva. Hey shalonu vehei lekupa shel yeshiva. 5 for us, 5 for the yeshiva's account. I don't know what the difference was, but let the IRS take it up. V'tzivanu uverachnu oscha baracha shiskamu b'chol v'zaracha v'zeras arachamu, your seed to be blessed. Now he starts. V'seder at tfilos u'bracha shoshana kulo shesha'alto, the order of the prayers and blessings for the whole year that you asked. Shiharonu min ha'shamayim, that we have been shown from heaven, meaning from Mesorah. Ra'inu l'sader v'ulo hashiv ki Mesorah shibiyadeinu, we have seen fit to arrange and to provide as our tradition. Ketikun tanon v'amoroim, as was ordained by the Talmudic sages. Now, of course, he starts with the Birchas HaShachar, but in some places he first offers a few relevant halachos and then the text. So it's not just the Siddur. It's more like an art scroll Siddur in that sense. You have the halachos of each tefillah that precedes it, as well as general introduction. But most of it is text. Birchas HaShachar, Pesukim in Zimra, Kriyat Shema, and Brachos. Again, when it comes to Birchas Kriyat Shema, he has all the statements of Chazal about the importance of Kriyat Shema, how Kriyat Shema should be recited, and then Shemoneh Esrei for weekdays, Rosh Chodesh, for Shabbos, for meals, for Beis Avol, for Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Chanukah. All in all, it's a guide that will be very familiar to us today in all respects, both the text and the accompanying halachos. There are Amram Don's Siddur was so widely distributed and used that we don't fully know what his original text was, because what happened was every community that got its hands on it, both in the Sephardic world and the Ashkenazic world, adapted it. They conformed it to its own needs, and they just called it Seder of Amram Gon, because that was the name of the authorized legitimate text, even if he did not in fact author everything in the subsequent editions. So for example, in some of the brachos, he just has the beginning of the bracha and the end, like in the Shemoneh Esrei, the main parts. And so you found that every community would fill in a different nusach with in the text of those brachos. Because it was so widely disseminated, it bears within its text indications of the changes. For example, in some of the printed editions of the Seder of Amram Gon, you find tshuvos from some of Rav Amram Gon's successors after his death, including from Sadra Gon, who will become the Gaon of Sura half century after of Amram's death. And every later edition of the Siddur, whether it's Rashi's Siddur or the Machzavitri from Rashi's disciples, it's all patterned after the Seder of Amram Gaon. That's why it's so familiar to us even today. That served another function as well. It's the very first compilation of Minhagim of the Jewish people that we have. And that was considered so authoritative that Rabbeinu Tam would write centuries later that many of our present customs originated with the Seder of Amram Gon, and we have to follow it unless a person can adduce a very good reason not to follow it. Even when we change something, Rav Amram Gon has to be reckoned with. So for example, we just had this a few weeks ago, you may have noticed in the Shulchan Aruch, Mechaber says that the blessing, the bracha for Ner Chanukah, is Lahadlik Ner Chanukah. That's what the Mechaber says. And Mishnah Berurah writes that we say the bracha Lahadlik Ner Shel Chanukah. Alright? And then he adds in the Shar Tzion, V'chein V'sheiltavs. That's the text you find in the Shiltas of Rechai Gaon, U'bahag, and the Halachas Gedolos of Rav Shimon Kayara, U'v'sidr of Amram Gaon. And that's what Rav Amram Gaon had as well, L'hadik Ner Shel Chanukah, and Mesecha Sofrim as well. So in fact, the common custom that we have, not to say L'hadik Ner Chanukah, but Ner Shel Chanukah, really stems from the Siddur of Amram Gaon and the Shiltas. Now some held the Halik Ner Chanukah was preferable, because without the shell, it means that Ner Chanukah, it's not Chanukah the holiday, but the Chetz Shel Mitzvah itself. So the Halik Ner Chanukah means that it's only to be used for Ner Chanukah and for no other purpose, as opposed to the Halik Ner Shel Shabbos. Here it doesn't mean the Chetz, but it means the day, because the Ner Shabbos is supposed to use for its light. It's not just a symbol like Ner Chanukah is of Chassidim Nisa. That's the svar behind the Hanukkah Ner Hanukkah. It's a good idea, but nonetheless, you see the Siddur of Rav Amram Gaon is the one that prevails in this case. In any event, Rav Amram Gaon's achievement was legendary, and it came at a most opportune time, because it was during his brief reign as Gaon of Sura that a new caliph began restrictive measures against Jews and Christians, including the mandatory wearing of a yellow badge. The first time we have that in Jewish life, then it was every Jew and Christian had to wear a yellow hood and a yellow belt in public. When that happened, Jews began to leave the yeshiva towns and concentrate in the big cities. Baghdad, Basra, Mosul is Nineveh, all the cities really have been in the news the last decade and a half, and Sur and Pumbedisa began a slow decline in both prestige and influence. By the end of the century, both yeshivos would relocate to Baghdad while retaining their original names. The first time that happened as well, but something which is very common in our world. The yeshiva of Sura, the yeshiva of Pumbedisa, spent the last several centuries of their existence not in Sura or Pumbedisa respectively, but in Baghdad. And yet they keep the names, like we have all yeshivas here named after different cities and towns in Europe. Another critical work published towards the end of the century, the Oruch of Rav Tzemach Gaon. You remember Rav Tzemach Gaon was referenced by Rav Amram Gaon in his introduction. The Oruch was the first dictionary of the Talmud. So by now, Arabic had replaced Aramaic as the spoken language of the Jews of Bavel. The Oruch translated 300 Aramaic terms into Arabic to make the study of Talmud more accessible, but the decline of Bavel had begun and would be irreversible. So therefore it was most fortunate that Rav Amram chose this particular time to compose his Siddur and to disseminate it across the world. The Jews of Bavel would have another great leader or two, Rav Sadri Gaon to be sure, in the 10th century, but already the center of Jewish life was shifting away from Bavel to Europe, where it remained for the better part of the next millennium. And for that, we pick up next week with the centurion of the 10th century. I thank you all again for coming out, and Erev Tov.